I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Her concern is for those disadvantaged and disempowered in a changing climate. Her goal is to ensure access to energy, water, and well-being for all. Today, Diana Liverman. She'll address ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, how can we adapt to current climate changes, and methods to achieve development goals that will end hunger and poverty. Then it's a two-hour tour showcasing the adventures and misadventures that propelled Kansas City women into the limelight. Hear from the two actors who lead the journey and share the lively stories of these women. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Here's a question for today's world. How can we reduce greenhouse gas emissions, adapt to climate changes already underway, and eradicate poverty and hunger? And how can we do all this while ensuring access to energy, water, and well-being for all? Diana Liverman wrestles with these huge questions as the region's professor of geography and development at the University of Arizona, where she's also the former co-director of the university's Institute for the Environment. She worked on a major report that dealt with these issues on behalf of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Diana Liverman was actually a co-author of the panel's Climate Change's Summary for Policymakers. The study looked at the consequences of global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius, and its findings released last fall raised concerns planet-wide about our collective futures. She'll be speaking at UMKC tonight. More on that in just a few minutes. Diana, what a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
It's lovely to be here. Beautiful spring day.
Absolutely. Fountain Day in Kansas City. You couldn't have timed it any better.
Exactly. We've already hit summer in Tucson, so.
Imagine that. Really, down in Arizona? I'm just shocked to hear that. So your work focuses on climate change and eradicating poverty and hunger. I gather you like big challenges.
Yes, I do. I think that it's hard to look at what's happening in the world and not see that at the same time climate's changing. We also have poverty. We have a lot of people with poor health. We have a lot of problems with growing cities, and we really have to tackle them all together.
Why take on so much at once? Aren't you just begging for frustration here?
Well, actually, there's so many synergies that in some ways taking them all on together makes it easier. And also, in terms of the report that we wrote last fall, those reports are for the United Nations. And the United Nations has taken on the challenge of climate change, but it's also adopted what we call the Sustainable Development Goals, which they agreed to in 2015. And that is 17 goals to try to make better lives for all. So the UN, in commissioning our report, asked us to address both issues together. So they set the challenge for us.
Help me understand this. When you say there are synergies between poverty and climate change and hunger, what are you talking about?
Well, one example would be when we have a natural disaster like a hurricane. Over and over again, it's the poor who suffer most. They don't have good housing. They don't have the resources to cope. Sometimes they don't even get the information that is needed. So if we can move people out of poverty, if we can eradicate poverty, which is what the UN wants us to do, then we're going to actually reduce vulnerability to climate extremes and climate change. So that's just one example. Reduce poverty, reduce vulnerability to natural disasters.
Can we eradicate poverty? Is that even in the realm of the possible?
Depends how we define it. So the last 25 years, the UN had something called the Millennium Development Goals, and their goal was to halve poverty worldwide, extreme poverty. That was people earning under $1.25 a day. People thought that was going to be impossible, but we actually met the goal.
Over
the last 25 years, we halved the proportion of people in extreme poverty worldwide. A big part of that actually was the growth in China's economy. China brought millions out of extreme poverty with the growth in their economy. But actually, worldwide, a lot of people improved their lives. They got access to clean drinking water. They got access to better sanitation. Infant mortality has dropped. So if you look back at the last 25 years, there's actually some hope that we can do these things.
That's a great example of we in the media tend to focus on the bad news. I guess I wasn't aware of that. I'm sitting here thinking as you're describing that, why didn't I know this?
I'm not sure. I think you're right. We do tend to focus on bad news. And even in my teaching as a university professor, students complain I don't give enough hope. So I've even changed the way I teach and I talk about these successes.
So you're like a good professor, maybe like I am. You get your feedback from your students. You try to be responsive to it. Good for you.
Try.
Well, let's talk about climate change because you're on the cutting edge of this issue. How much temperature rise is now expected between today and 2030, Diana? What are you seeing there?
Well, we've already seen a 1 degree C increase.
So, 1 degree Celsius.
Yeah, well, yeah. So that's about 1.7 Fahrenheit. So, mm-hmm. And what we'll see between now and 2030 depends on the choices we make. So if we go along with what we call business as usual, if we don't do anything to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, then on current estimates, we could be heading for 3 degrees C of warming.
Three additional degrees.
So that's 5 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
What we look at in the report is, could we actually limit that warming to just another half degree more Celsius of warming? And what we find, of course, is that's very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look towards the end of the century in particular, then we could, if we didn't do anything, be looking at much, much warmer temperatures across the whole world. And a global average warming of 3 degrees is actually a lot more at the poles, a lot more in certain parts of the world.
And the report talks about how important it is to keep climate change, the increase in temperature, to just a half degree more. Once we go past that, the consequences are fairly catastrophic.
I don't want to use the term catastrophic. I think people have to judge what they think catastrophic is, because some people will be able to cope, partly because of this differential vulnerability. Where I think people are seeing catastrophe is partly what it does to the poor, but also what it does to ecosystems. So one of the findings of our report, we actually looked at how much half a degree of extra warming matters. And we initially thought maybe not so much, but one thing we found, for example, is at 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, tropical corals survive. If you go just another half degree more, they disappear. 100 million more people are thrown into poverty as you go from 1.5 degrees to 2 degrees. A lot more people suffer heat stress and water stress. So one of our conclusions was it does make a difference whether you aim to limit to 1.5 or to 2 or to 3. Every bit of warming matters.
You've told interviewers that you've been working on climate change for a long time, about 30 years. And you said you're amazed by how much has to happen to keep that climate rise below 1.5 degrees. We need to cut emissions by half before 2030 and go carbon neutral by 2050. Explain what those twin challenges are all about.
Well, first of all, if when I started working on climate change 30 years ago, we'd started to do something, we wouldn't be facing these enormous challenges now. And if we wait even a few years now, it's going to be even harder than we lay out in the IPCC report.
There's a compounding effect, you're saying.
Yeah, because if we want to, it takes time to get emissions down, particularly when you're talking about a massive transformation of the energy system. If we're going to drastically reduce fossil fuel use, especially coal, and transition to renewables, that takes time worldwide to make those sorts of transitions, even though they are happening in some parts of the world. So the challenge of what we propose, which is if we want to stay under 1.5 degrees, we've pretty much got to cut emissions in half in the next 12 years. That is an enormous challenge. Our report concluded you could do it, but it would require increased investments in the energy system. And the other thing we talk about is the need to do everything we can to get greenhouse gases out of the air. That means protecting forests. It means farming in a sort of climate smart way. But it also means developing some technologies like carbon capture and storage, which will take carbon dioxide out of the air and power stations, but we don't have those technologies now at scale or in a way that's affordable.
So this is why you say you're amazed by how much has to get done quickly here. As
yes.
you look at the political climate in this country with this president, how hopeful are you that the kinds of changes are going to be kicked into place that will lead us to the place where you think maybe we need to be?
Well, I get asked that a lot when I talk internationally. And one of my responses is, whatever our federal government does, whoever is in power, actually a lot of the action is happening below the federal level. So there's a report recently that added up everything that cities are doing, that states are doing, like California. I mean, California is one of the largest economies in the world and has said they're going to cut their emissions by 80%. They're aiming for carbon neutrality. So if you actually add up all the local and state actions, all the actions that are being taken by business, the U.S. is actually doing a lot, irrespective of what's happening in Washington.
So people have taken the mantle up on their own, like Mayor Sly James here in Kansas City has taken a number of steps, and you're saying that's being replicated all over the place.
Yes, it is. And mm-hmm. of course, it can be supported by federal action. It can be slowed by federal action. But I do have hope of what's going on in this country because of all of those actions that are going on across that country.
Climate change and what has to get done. That's our topic this morning. We're visiting with Diana Liverman. She is with the University of Arizona. She's former co-founder of the university's Institute for the Environment. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What's the toughest nut for us to crack as you look down the road? What's the hardest thing for us to deal with?
I think providing affordable, low-carbon choices, both for people coming out of poverty around the world so that they can travel, so that they can make a living without producing a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. But even here at home, I think a lot of people would like to do more, but they can't afford to put solar on their house. They can't afford an electric car. We need to find ways to make the low carbon transition affordable. Mm-hmm. And the second big challenge, I think, is the research and development for technologies, because I'm not sure that we will be able to reduce the emissions as fast or as much as we need. And that's why I would like to see much more success in these technologies that will take greenhouse gases out of the air if possible.
I'm wondering, how close are we to seeing solar panels on the roofs of middle and upper middle class homes in the Kansas City area? Do you have any feel for that?
I don't know what's going on in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you or your audience can help me.
What's happening down in Arizona?
Well, not enough, actually. People are shocked when they fly into Phoenix or Tucson. They expect to see everybody have solar panels on their roofs.
There's and a lot they of don't. Sun down there. Yeah,
there is. But the upfront costs are still high. You know, it's $10,000 to $20,000 to get an array, because we've got to put a lot of solar panels up there in order to air condition our houses. There's sort of a feedback there, right? Climate's warming. You need more panels to cool your house. So the upfront costs are high. And Arizona's not a wealthy state. Many people, you tell them, oh, there's a tax break. Well, they're not earning enough to pay the taxes to get the tax break. Mm-hmm. They can't get the loans to put the panels on. So then the big challenge is, what are utilities willing to do? So there is pressure on utilities in Arizona to shift away from fossil fuels. They've got investments in infrastructure. They have some people who are skeptical about climate change. So one of the big discussions we have to have is whether we want our utilities to reduce their greenhouse gases overall for everybody, or whether we rely on individual action that perhaps only a certain number of individuals can afford.
What do you think the better way to go is?
Probably utility-wide. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's...
That would raise the utility costs, though, wouldn't it?
It would, but if you spread it across the whole population, perhaps not to a very significant amount. And we also have to trade it off with the impacts we're experiencing. Mm-hmm. So if the warming means higher air conditioning costs, but you can reduce the warming, then maybe it's a trade-off.
Let's go to some phone calls, 816-235-2888. We're talking about the challenges of climate change, how all that is connected with poverty and hunger. 816-235-2888. Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Kevin.
I wanted to ask, I'm a local environmental activist. I work with a group of a coalition between Sierra Club and the Sunrise Movement, and we want to talk about the Green New Deal at a town hall next week. And so we want to know how do we engage folks who are low income in minority communities who aren't currently really engaged, especially on environmental issues? How do we work better together to talk about local solutions?
How do you grow the number of people invested and interested in climate change, Diana?
Well, I think it's growing every year. There are so many people now. I'm out in my community all the time, and there are people who are very concerned. However, I do know that when you have meetings, when you have talks, a lot of the very low-income folks, they don't have time to come to the meetings. They're working really hard to look after their families. They may not have easy transportation. In the Southwest, we need to make a lot of material accessible in Spanish, which it hasn't been before, because that would access a lot of our populations. So I think talking about climate justice as part of general social justice issues is important. And I also think we do have to think about people's particular situation. Is climate really their number one issue that they're thinking about? Low-income populations have so many challenges that they're facing, and we can see this in surveys. So I think what we have to do is to think about ways to talk about solving the other problems that are a greater priority for them, whilst also addressing some of the climate issues. So whether it's reducing energy costs, food justice, making sure people have health care to deal with heat waves, those might all help with reaching the population.
Hope that helps, Kevin.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Absolutely does.
Thanks for calling. You know, which Kevin's call, you know, brings me to a point. You know, you do sense urgency in society these days in some quarters, but you don't sense the degree to which the urgency has to be widespread to really kickstart and demand the kind of change that folks like you are suggesting that we need to make here. What about that? Do you sense the same thing? How do you view it?
Well, you know, I'm a scientist, so I look at the data. And if you look at the surveys that come out on a regular basis from Yale, there's very high levels of concern about climate change. The majority of people now think that it's happening, and that actually is a bipartisan finding. I think the debate is more about what we do about it. What is the role of government in facilitating that transition? What's the role of business? And what can individuals do? And it really has to be all of those sectors working together to make this transition.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our number here. Let's go back to some calls. And Bob from Paola on the Kansas side. Bob, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I had a question for the doctor. Locally, we've seen about a 70% increase in electric rates from Kansas City Power and Light. But you also mentioned kind of the impact on global warming on the poor. But you were saying that we need the solution to be at the utility level. Well, poor people spend a whole lot more on a percentage of their income for electricity from the utilities. So how do you reconcile? So they're going to be impacted a whole lot more than the wealthy if their electric utilities are being increased because of solutions to global warming. How do you suggest solving that problem? It's almost like a regressive tax.
Right. Mm-hmm. Diana?
Well, I think there's a couple of things you can do. Many utilities already have progressive pricing where there are subsidies for the poorest groups, or they will do things like help with insulation, help with putting in energy efficient light bulbs. So we already have many utilities that do address that. But another thing people are talking about is a carbon tax in the US that would be a carbon fee and dividend, where you would pay a certain amount on your utility bill or on your gasoline that would be a modest tax on the carbon emissions, all of that money would then go back on a per capita basis to people across the United States, mm-hmm. in which case poor who don't emit a lot would get the equal dividend to everybody else. So that would be something also that would help with poverty at the same time as addressing climate change. And there is some support for that in Congress and in different states.
I should point out that Diana Liverman will be speaking this evening at 6:30 at Pearson Auditorium on the UMKC campus in connection with the Spring Cockafair Lecture. Her talk is titled Reducing the Risks of Climate Change and Ending Poverty, Synergies, Trade-offs, and the Hope for Sustainable Development. The event is free. It's open to the public, but you should RSVP to reserve a spot at info.umkc.edu/cockafair, or just show up tonight. But 6:30 this evening at Pearson Auditorium. Let's go back to some calls. And Dan from Lee Summit. Dan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if Diane knew of any program or any thought for any program to may alleviate the poor's inability to take part in alternative energy by maybe creating a jobs program nationwide where they can get in training to install solar panels and alternative energy and work that way where they can make, earn a living and also help alleviate the problems of the energy crisis?
Jobs programs for the poor, Diana.
I don't know of any specifically, but my understanding is that is part of what's proposed under the Green New Deal is the provision of green jobs. I do know where that's happened in Europe, where there have been job creation programs around home refurbishment, around putting solar panels on. And actually, there's a really interesting historical precedent, which is when we went through the Great Depression, you may recall we created the Civilian Conservation Corps that actually created a lot of the infrastructure for our national parks and our national forests, where that actually was a green jobs program during the 1930s.
It's one of the issues out there, Diana, and you don't hear people talking about it very much, this whole idea of population control. Do we have too many people on this planet? And I'm thinking, how can you conclude any other way than we sure do?
We have a lot of people on this planet, but in our report, and also when I talk about the good news, is that to some extent, the population problem has been solved in the most humanitarian way possible.
How is that?
In the last couple of decades, the fertility rate, which is the number of children each woman will have in her reproductive lifetime, has dropped precipitously. Hmm. It used to be 5 children per woman worldwide. We're now less than 3.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's another. And the reason that has happened is improvements in the status of women. They're better off. They can have jobs, they have reproductive rights, they have pensions, and infant mortality has dropped, so they're not having children just to make sure some survive. And that has been, in a sense, I say the women of the world have sort of, with the help of the men, have solved a lot of the population problem. So what we're looking at is the possibility that population growth is actually going to level off and start to decline by the middle of the century. In many countries, it's already doing so. Now, that doesn't mean population isn't contributing to greenhouse gas emissions. But the real challenge now, policy-wise, is the consumption of each child that's born, particularly as they become better off. But that drop in fertility is another thing that we don't talk about very much. And it wasn't coerced. It was something that was the choice that has been made by a lot of women worldwide, that smaller families are better, less vulnerable, and can thrive.
Let's go back to some phone calls, and we'll go to Rick from Independence. Rick, good morning.
Good morning. Some interesting information on solar power. We have 12 deserts in our southwest. And according to one scientist, we can blanket only 2 of those deserts, and we can produce enough solar power to power our entire country. And this is being done in Mexico right now. They have, they're building solar farms that are so huge, and you can see a picture of them. You can't see the circumference unless you're 1,000 foot in the air. And they expect to have 40% of the entire country on solar power within 6 years.
Wow.
They're building at an incredible rate.
Do you know much about that, Diana?
I know some about it because I do work in Mexico. And also, we do have some large-scale commercial farms going in Arizona. The one thing I would say is that the deserts of the southwestern Mexico are also some of the most biodiverse places on the planet. We have amazingly rich biodiversity, vegetation, critters that live in our deserts. And so one of the things we need to be careful about is where do we put those solar panels? So one of the debates is perhaps the solar panels should go into sort of brownfield sites, as you would call them, and make sure that we don't encroach on the wildlands that are so important to recreation and to biodiversity. But solar panels are getting much cheaper. They are going in a lot of places. So I think there's a lot of optimism about transitions to solar. And it's not just in the Southwest. In fact, in Arizona, it sometimes gets too hot for the panels to work properly.
No kidding.
They get less efficient. But a colleague of mine has come up with a really great technology called agrovoltaics, where you put your solar panels over crops. The evaporation from the crops cools the panels, and the panels make the crops grow better.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. Well, if we were to do something ambitious like Mexico is doing in our Southwest, would that enable us to achieve some of our greenhouse gas goals just overnight?
Not overnight, because of the challenge it takes to build up the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And there are some issues around intermittency. You know, solar's not on at night, so we need to figure out battery storage or backup from, some people suggest, gas or nuclear or hydro, so that we can make sure that we have an even supply of electricity.
Okay. Back to some calls here. Rick from South Kansas City. Rick, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to stress to your audience, I don't think that we're doing enough to communicate the financial value that accrues to a family when they do solar. I'm getting more than 15% return on my money. I will get that for the 25 years life of the system. There is no place in the marketplace that I can go for that type of guarantee because I can't live without my electricity. So I know that that's going to be there every single day. And I think if people would spend more effort in helping people understand, you don't have to do a whole house. You could do just a piece of it and then add to it over time as your financial ability allows. But that return on your investment will always be there.
Rick, any sense, what does it cost to place solar panels, say for half your electrical usage on a medium-sized house? Any rough sense?
My utility bill was $250. My electric bill was $250 a month. I spent $35,000 after tax credits. The net cost to me is $21,000. I saved $2,400 this past year alone.
Wow.
And it will continue to increase. Every time there's an increase in from KCP&L, my savings will go up.
Okay. He could be a salesman for the solar industry, it sounds like, Diana.
Absolutely. I think there are probably jobs being created right now.
That's the potential that's out there. Again, Diana Liverman will speak this evening at 6:30 at Pearson Auditorium on the UMKC campus. More information, info.umkc.edu/cockafair. Diana, thanks for some great information. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about a tour that's capitalizing on that Kansas City song about crazy little women in this town. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we spoke with the co-author of a new study on the impact of voter ID laws. Here are the surprising results he discovered at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, how direct primary health care works. It's a growing trend that offers a more personal way to get care without the costly constraints of insurance. We'll learn how that works on tomorrow's KCUR's Up to Date.
Go to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. Going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. They got some crazy little women. Stop. I'm gonna get me one.
Well, that song says it pretty well. We've had some crazy little women in this town, as Muddy Waters just sang. And Visit KC these days is capitalizing on the song and our history and offering what it calls the Crazy Little Women Tour on Friday evenings. The two-hour tour is led by two veteran actresses, Wendy Thompson and Jessica Whitfield, and it showcases the adventures and misadventures that propelled KC women into the limelight throughout the years. The two tell tales of KC's most famous madam, an equestrian who was known throughout the world, women who began hospitals and art museums, women who broke through the gender barriers in many fields, and kidnapped women who refused to be victims. Our two guides are with us here this morning. Jessica Whitfield, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wendy Thompson, good to have you as well. Welcome.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you.
Now, help me with these characters here, Jessica, because you play Valencia on these tours, and Wendy, you play Moonbeam. How would you describe your characters?
So Valencia is a hipster. She's a millennial, and she loves social media, trying to be cool, wearing scarves, all that type of stuff.
Yeah, and Wendy, you play the other character. You play Moonbeam. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Moonbeam's a little overgrown hippie, a bit of a tree hugger, very concerned about the environment, not so hip on the technology nowadays.
Yeah. Wendy, you say that Kansas City history has always inspired you, and I'm wondering how.
It's just always fascinated me. I've had to do some research for different roles over the years, and it's just amazing. The women's history in particular, how they helped build the fabric, and they don't get much credit for it sometimes. So yeah. It's some pretty interesting stuff.
What are some of the roles you've played over the years?
I played Molly Brown. I played Anna Nearing, who was the matron of Union Station for 37 years. That was a lot of fun. I've been a Harvey girl.
Yes.
So those are some of the historical ones.
The Harvey Cafe down in Union Station back in the day, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Jessica, you started the tour in March for Women's History Month. But, you know, how far back did you start pulling this thing together?
Yes, we've been doing research for several months before we actually launched this tour, and it took a little more time than we were expecting because there was a lot of research that needed to be done. We had to write out the dialogue for our characters, and there was a lot of memorizing, so it was a lot of work.
So it's not as easy as it sounds here, it doesn't
exactly.
sound like. How did you get involved in this thing? I mean, where did the idea, how did you get dragged into this?
Yeah. That's my fault.
Yeah.
Wendy asked me to join her. I've known Wendy for several years. We've worked together doing tours, doing some acting projects. And so that's kind of how I got roped into it.
Yeah. And have you done some of these kinds of tours before?
Well, yes and no. We've done historical tours. We both do the historical tours at Union Station, and we've done other things like that. This is the first time we've been on a moving vehicle, and we have found that amazingly different, exciting and fun, but a lot more different in having to work on our timing and blanking out all the distractions that come while
police sirens,
yeah.
People honking.
Yeah. How do you manage all that? How do you navigate that?
Well, thankfully we have a bus driver who does most of it. But yeah, we have to learn to put our blinders on in certain spots so that we can just focus on the story and our audience.
It's just taken some getting used to.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's a moving vehicle then, Jessica, that added some challenges to putting this whole script together, right?
Yes. So we've discovered that, we haven't quite got up to Corinthian Hall at the time that we're expecting. So we need to put in another story here in between Annie Chambers and Lula Long. So we did a lot of moving around of the stories, and we even added some extra stories just in case we get stuck and need some extra time.
Yeah. So we have fillers, in other words. And we've even actually chopped up a couple and done a part of it here and a part of it there sometimes.
Wow. Tell us about Annie Chambers. You just mentioned her, Jessica. Who was she?
Yes, Annie Chambers was the most famous madam in Kansas City.
And what happened to her?
Well, she operated out of the River Market. And so we drive by the building, which it doesn't look like it did back in the day. It's different now. But we do drive by the building, which was Annie Chambers Resort, where her mansion was.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, was it a mansion?
Yeah, it was 25-room mansion, very opulent. It was known as the most opulent brothel in the region.
But it's not there anymore.
No.
Yeah, but you have the site marked then. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, there's an office building there now, so people are working out of a building that used to be a brothel.
Oh, that's funny. But she went through some big changes in her life because she went through a life-changing moment at some point, right?
Yes, she did. Saw the light, so to speak. Reverend David Bulkley lived next door to her mansion, and when she died, she gave her house and grounds to the City Union Mission.
There you go. How did you decide on the characters of Moonbeam and Valencia?
Well, we wanted to make this a comedy tour, so we wanted to bring in some humor, and we thought it would be funny if we had a generational gap. So if Moonbeam was this hippie that knew a lot of interesting history facts, and I'm kind of the more modern day hipster. I don't know a lot of the history stuff, but I know some of the modern day women and some of the modern day things about Kansas City that Moonbeam doesn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so trying to communicate is where the comedy comes in.
Yeah. How much time did you spend researching all this? And again, that must have been labor that maybe you hadn't anticipated.
It was fun. I like writing, and I had fun learning about all these women and developing my character. I even did research on a lot of acronyms and hipster slang to kind of add some character to the tour.
Yeah. How many women do you highlight on the whole thing?
We tell 26 different stories, but some of those stories have multiple women. We have three stories about sisters, mm-hmm. the Jones sisters, the Berry sisters, the Winstead sisters, so and things like that.
Several jazz women.
Oh, yeah. Many, many. The jazz women actually is kind of a long list.
Is that Winstead's as in Winstead's restaurant?
That's right.
And there were sisters that gave birth to that?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
It was Catherine Winstead, and her sisters were Nellie and Fanny. Mm-hmm. And Catherine actually started the first Winsteads in Springfield, Illinois, but that was the first drive-in restaurant in the United States.
Huh, really?
Yeah, so Kansas City's location was actually their third opening, their third location.
Are the restaurants still in Illinois?
You know, I don't know that.
Or just because obviously it's a big landmark here in Kansas City.
It is, yeah.
And the location on the plaza was the very first Winstead's that had both a dine-in restaurant and a drive-in.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
The one on the plaza?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, I've been by it many times. It's just amazing. Well, can you guys do a little segment from the tour to give us a sense of what all this sounds like? You brought something, right? You're
sure.
both smiling here. Yeah,
we could do that.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Set it up for us.
Well, the Jazz District, you know, those jam sessions would go on all night long.
Oh, those parties sound so lit.
Well, yeah, man. I'm surprised you don't know this, man.
Man, did you just assume my gender?
Your what?
I happen to identify as female, BT Dubs.
Cool, man.
OMG, did you just forget what I just said?
I don't understand half of what you say, man.
Man, can we just get back to the jazz women?
Oh, sure, man. I mean, sure, woman.
That's more like it.
Yeah. Crazy little woman, I tell ya. Yeah.
And there it is. Yeah. Yeah. It gives you a sense of what this all is. So it's a huge generational gap here, you can tell. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's highlight a few of the other women that you feature in this tour and why they were included. Let's start with Gladys Twine, who was, I'm told, Kansas City's Rosa Parks. I've got to tell you, I've not heard of Gladys Twine. Who was she?
She basically started the civil rights movement in Kansas City in the sense that Rosa Parks did as well. It wasn't quite the same situation, but she was denied. She was shopping in a downtown department store in 1957, and they would let her buy her clothes there as long as she didn't try them on first.
Oh, really?
Yeah, rude.
And how did she react to that?
Well, she went in and spent her money in the store. She did her shopping and then realized she was thirsty and went to their tea room to get a beverage, and they refused to serve her.
You should not get in the way of a thirsty woman.
Amen, sister, let me tell you.
Yeah.
So she went to her friend Ruth Kerford, who was president of the Twin Cityans, which was an all-female black organization. She told Ruth and the other members what had happened to her. And then they went to Lucille Bluford, which, you know, was the publisher of the Kansas City Call at the time.
Right, yeah.
And when she heard about it, of course, it spread. The word spread quickly throughout the city. And they
she wrote about it, it sounds like. Yeah, yes. She put something in the paper. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, they basically started the civil rights movement. They wrote letters. They held protests. It was a lot like Rosa Parks. And they really took off with it. And it by February of 59, the management of Macy's, Klein's, and Peck's had all announced they were immediately desegregating their dining areas.
No kidding.
And soon the rest of the department stores in town just followed suit.
Her name again, Gladys Twine. It sounds like she's worth reading a little bit about.
Yeah.
Let's turn now to Mary Atkins, Jessica. Mm-hmm. She's the Atkins in the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Tell
That's
us about
right.
her.
Yeah, so Mary Atkins is the Atkins in the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. And so her husband had left her a sizable fortune. And she...
Good guy.
Yeah. but she didn't really enjoy literature or community events. And they say that after he died, she didn't smile for a whole year. So, yeah. I kind of call that RBF. And so, yeah, a lot of her money was left to and combined with a gift from William Rockwell Nelson to build the Nelson and to provide all the art that we see there today.
Mm-hmm. That's quite a development and quite a contribution to our city.
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful, beautiful museum, and we're lucky to have it.
Did you know about Gladys Twine or Mary Atkins before you took all this on?
So I didn't know the story about Mary Atkins. Gladys Twine was actually my idea because when I went to the American Jazz Museum, they had a documentary playing there, which featured stories about Gladys Twine.
Oh, is that
and
right?
And I realized, wow, I've never heard of this woman, but she was really important. And so maybe about a year later, once we started work on the tour, I had this idea, hey, we should include Gladys Twine in our tour.
Okay. Another woman you feature here, Tierra Farrow, our first female lawyer. Tell us about her, Wendy.
Oh, yeah. She's a fun story. Very community-minded, really a suffragette in her own way. But she was our first female lawyer. She actually got her law degree in 1903. Hmm. And the big flood almost kept her from attending her own commencement. She had
to hire
a rowboat and row to it.
No kidding.
No kidding.
Yeah.
She set up her offices, but her first few years were really lean years because most people thought a woman should work for less or for free even.
Hmm.
You know, so she it wasn't until she handled a very sensational murder case that she became fairly well known in the community.
Mm-hmm.
But she was always focused on helping women throughout her career. The murder case that we're talking about was involving a woman who actually shot her ex-husband in the courthouse.
Yeah.
So it got to be quite the big sensation.
It's like an episode of Law & Order SVU.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. So which came first, the woman featured on the tour or the tour stop itself? I mean, how did you manage to find women and the sites that they're associated with and Corey, and sync all that with the tour you take around town?
Well,
there's a lot of moving parts here.
Yes. So we kind of thought about the women we wanted to feature first.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, one of the women, Lula Long Combs, we thought, well, she was a very important woman of Kansas City. And we can drive by Corinthian Hall, where she lived, and include that on the tour. Mary Atkins, of course, the Nelson Atkins, we wanted to drive by that.
Right.
And some of the women, like Gladys Twine, we didn't really have a specific location to feature. So we kind of use some of those stories as just in between stops that we're going to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although we talk about Gladys when we're downtown, which
yes.
was a downtown department store was where mm-hmm. it started. So we do kind of try to focus on it. But some of the women we don't have a specific on. But we always started with the women. You know,
mm-hmm.
finding an interesting story was the first key.
Hey, how many hours of rehearsal to get your characters and the stories of all these women down pat? What kind of effort are we talking about here?
Oh, we can't even count them, I don't think.
Yeah.
We really started this last August. So, I mean, it's really been a lot. We got our first draft done probably late in the fall and then realized we probably needed to write some more because we didn't think we had the timing worked out. Then we got on the trolley for the first time and realized we had to cut a little back. So it's
been too much material.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes
we did.
Yeah, we could probably do a whole nother tour with different women.
Could you really?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. How long does a tour last?
It's actually a total of 2 hours, but we do take a break in the Jazz District and let people get off and walk around. There's a nice little daiquiri bar there that's owned by a woman. The place is called Smacks, Dining mm-hmm. with the Diva. And you can get off and have a daiquiri or relax or just walk around for a few minutes and take a break and then get back on the trolley and we finish it up.
Yeah. Wendy, you were saying that doing these presentations on a moving vehicle, what are some of the other challenges that that presents? You mentioned sirens and everything else. What else goes on there?
Well, mostly it's for a performer, it's your timing, especially when we're trying to do some comedy. You know, timing's everything with comedy.
Yes, I was going
to
say.
Yeah, but knowing how long a story is, you know, looking around the corner to see the driver's really just 2 blocks away from where you need to be ending a story.
Yeah.
Suddenly that requires some on-the-spot editing.
Sometimes we start talking faster. Sometimes we start talking slower.
To fit it all in. So who was the woman that you highlight that really grabbed your attention and made you sort of sit up and take notice, Jessica?
I was really fascinated by the story of Mary McElroy and mm-hmm. her kidnapping.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just so bizarre that I thought, wow, we can really, you know, make some comedic bits with this of how she got kidnapped and the responses from the kidnappers. It was really fascinating.
Remind people a little bit more what that was about.
Yes. So Mary McElroy was 25 when she got kidnapped. She was the daughter of a judge. And the kidnappers came to her house and they stopped because she was taking a bubble bath. And she said, I can't be kidnapped right now. You have to wait. And they waited. Yes, they were very polite. They were gentlemen. They waited for her to finish. And when they told them they were demanding $60,000 in exchange for her release, she told them that she was worth more than that.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, that's moxie under a pressure-packed moment. Yeah. Who grabbed you, Wendy, in terms of a woman who stood out to you?
Oh, wow. Probably Nell Donnelly. She's an amazing story, and there's a kidnapping involved there, too, which was rather scandalous at the time.
Yes.
But she came out of that so well and was just an exemplary person and businesswoman. And
I get to remind people who she was.
She was the first female millionaire in the United States. She owned the largest garment manufacturing plant right here in Kansas City in the world. So she was just an amazing businesswoman. She was a clothing manufacturer and a designer and was very wealthy and got kidnapped and was having a little bit of a tryst with a senator who really called in all the gangsters to go find her when she got kidnapped.
It wasn't a little bit of a tryst either, right?
Yeah.
It was the real thing.
It was.
This tour leaves from Union Station at 4 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays. How do you sign up for it? Or you just show up?
No, you can go on to kcfuntours.com to buy your tickets online, or you can buy them at the station at the info booth before the trolley takes off. But we do leave right at 4, so you need to get there a little before that.
And it's suggested for ages 14 and up. Do I have that right?
That is correct.
Okay. Jessica Whitfield, thanks for sharing your stories with us. I sure appreciate it. Wendy Thompson, good to have you here as well.
Thank you.
Good luck with the tours, okay?
Thanks for having us.
Look out for the sirens and the honking horns and everything else. Yeah.
Thank you.
If you want to hear the tips our smart money experts have for creating and keeping a good credit score, you can find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, how a Missouri program works to guide foster kids aging out of the system into gainful employment. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.